Hello, this is Matt Woodbury, and I'll be bringing you the first half of news from the Pantograph, edition dated Friday, September 15th, 2017. We'll start with an article on the first page entitled School Welcomes Families, Ridgeview Gives Tips on Literacy, Books to Newborns and Districts, by Julia Evilsizer. At just a few weeks old, babies born in the Ridgeview School District are already connecting with their future school. Officials at Ridgeview Elementary School in Colfax organized the Community Literacy Initiative this year, which they affectionately refer to as Books for Babies. The school is giving a book, Good Night Moon, and literacy advice to parents of every infant born in the district. Administrators sign the inside cover of the book with a greeting for the babies. The goal is to make sure parents understand their role as a great source of information to their kids, especially through reading, and to know they have our support here at the school, said Principal Ben Hutley. Jessica and Jake Thorndike of Saybrook were the first parents to receive a book a few weeks ago for their newborn daughter Mackenzie. "We're trying to establish a little library in our home to read to the baby. It's nice to be able to have more options for her now. It's important for us to read to her, even now, so she can hear so many different words and sounds. Hopefully, this helps her develop a habit of wanting to read later on," said Jessica Thorndike. The Thorndikes are also graduates of the Ridgeview School District and are excited to enroll their daughter in kindergarten there down the road. "It's awesome this is something they want to do and that they're so eager to reach out to new parents in the community," said Jessica Thorndike. Ridgeview Elementary librarian Lauren Schuler said families can contact the school office to sign up for a book. School officials can either meet families at the building or at their home. "This is a way to encourage literacy and highlight the importance of reading. We want families to feel welcome at the district and know we value their children and education," said Schuler. Kelly Richards of Colfax stopped by the school on Thursday with her stepson Gabe Anderson, 3, and infant daughter Autumn Anderson. "We plan on sending her to school here, and the fact that the district noticed her and cares about her already is great," said Richards, also a Ridgeway graduate. "It's a small school, but it's very in touch with students academically and socially." Kelly Borton, a Title I teacher at the school, presented the gift to Richards in Autumn, explaining how Goodnight Moon is a great pick for young readers because it includes all phonetic sounds in the English language. "It's a great book for children to read at every age and practice pronunciations while they build a relationship with their parents," said Borton. Borton said no parent is born knowing how to teach their children to read, so having some guidance and support from the school can help them before the kids enroll in kindergarten. "When kids start kindergarten, they should have a good idea of their letters and how to spell their name. If they know that much, they'll have more success in school," said Borton. She said for many new parents, this program is the first introduction to their child's potential future school. "It's a good way to make them feel more comfortable," said Borton. "We want them to know the school is an extended family, where teachers work together for their child." Next, we have an article that's entitled, "Driver Charged with DUI in Crash, Indiana Woman ID'd as Victim of Collision," written by Kevin Barlow. A Carmel, Indiana woman was identified Thursday as the victim of a fatal crash in which the driver of the other vehicle is jailed on preliminary charges of driving under the influence and leaving the scene of an accident. Phyllis Graver, 79, was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash on Bloomington's southeast side at 12:43 p.m. Wednesday. Preliminary autopsy results indicate that she died from cervical spine injuries due to the collision between a sports utility vehicle and a minivan. Graver was the passenger in the SUV that left the roadway and rolled over after the crash, McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis said in a statement released Thursday afternoon. An older man who was driving the SUV was seriously injured. He was transported to OSF Healthcare in St. Joseph Medical Center. Police said Thursday the man is expected to survive, but has not been identified. The van driver, Darren R. Scott, 54, of Bloomington, was arrested at noon Wednesday, about 30 minutes after the crash, near Morrissey Drive and Crispin Lane in southeast Bloomington. Bloomington police said witnesses reported seeing a red van leave the scene of the crash traveling north on US 150. BPD released photos of the van Thursday morning in a statement announcing the arrest of Scott, who is due in court on Friday. He also has a Tuesday court date on a previous DUI charge. Jail records indicate he was arrested at 10:31 a.m. August 14th by BPD. He posted $100 and was released. He has not yet made a plea in that case. In that incident, police said Scott was arrested after he refused a field sobriety test. An accident report indicates he was involved in a two-way vehicle crash at Cloud Street and Kreitzer Avenue. There were no injuries reported. He was charged with DUI, leaving the scene of an accident, operating an uninsured vehicle, and improper lane usage. Scott also has several other traffic tickets. In 2009, he pled guilty to failure to reduce speed and failure to give information or render aid after an accident. In 2007, he pleaded guilty to driving on a suspended license and operating an uninsured vehicle. He received court supervision for those pleas. Anyone who saw the van in southeast Bloomington or along US 150 at Tawanda Barnes Road between 9 and 11:30 a.m. Wednesday is asked to contact Detective Tim Power at 309-434-2579 or tpower@cityblm.org. If you want to remain anonymous, call McLean County Crime Stoppers at 309-828-1111. If your call leads to the arrest and indictment of suspects, you may be eligible for a reward of up to $1,000. In other news, our next article is entitled Fatal Wreck Crashes Tie Up I-74. A fatal one-vehicle accident and at least two subsequent crashes involving at least nine more vehicles kept traffic down to one lane in each direction late Thursday night on Interstate 74 on Normal's northwest edge. State police said the first crash happened about 4 p.m. on the eastbound side at mile marker 125 near the Mitsubishi Motorway exit. The vehicle was in the left lane when it veered left. The driver overcorrected, causing the vehicle to spin out and strike the guardrail on the right side, police said. The driver died at Peoria Hospital, police said. The slowed traffic subsequently led to a rear-end chain-reaction crash of seven vehicles at mile marker 122 on the eastbound side. One person suffered injuries that did not appear to be life-threatening. There was a report about 7:30 p.m. of two semi-trailer trucks being involved in a rear-end crash on the westbound side at mile marker 123. State police continued to investigate the scene late Thursday, so complete accident reports were not available. Next, we have an article entitled, Coroner, Man Likely Drowned in Sugar Creek, Body Found Near Constitution Trail Examined, Identified. A 33-year-old Bloomington man found dead Wednesday in Sugar Creek in Normal apparently drowned, McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis said late Thursday afternoon. She identified him as Marcus D. Bivens. There was no assault, strangulation, infection, recent significant trauma, or tumor, said Davis, citing preliminary autopsy findings. Toxicology results are pending. The police were notified at 4:06 p.m. Wednesday that the body of a man was discovered near a bridge along Constitution Trail near the 300 block of South Veterans Parkway between College Avenue and General Electric Road. Coroner's office pronounced the man dead at 4:50 p.m. at the scene. The circumstances of Bivens' death remains under investigation by the Normal Police Department and the Coroner's Office. We are still investigating and working with the Coroner's Office, but have nothing new to release yet, Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner said before Davis's statement. Anyone who traveled through this area, including Constitution Trail, during the early part of the week and thinks they may have information about the case is asked to contact Detective Brad Park at 309-454-9527 or bpark@normal.org. If you want to remain anonymous, call McLean County Crime Stoppers at 309-828-1111. If your call leads to the arrest and indictment of suspects, you may be eligible for a reward of up to $1,000. Continuing with other news, we have another article that's entitled Jury Sees Chaos of Home Invasion. A Bloomington man shared his regrets with the jury Thursday over his decision to tell a friend about his role in a home invasion in which a couple allegedly was robbed at gunpoint on Oxford Court. Kendrick Cooley, a co-defendant in a September 7, 2016 break-in at the Bloomington home, spent 6 hours on the witness stand in the trial of Isaiah Miller. Miller, 20, of Bloomington, who is accused of home invasion, armed robbery, residential burglary, and an aggravated battery. Cooley said his disclosure to his friend, who later was a police informant, about the break-in resulted in his arrest a month after the offense. "I didn't believe the police were after me. My judgment was thrown off. I was on top of the world," Cooley said of the days after the break-in that netted him the victim's gun, $800 cash, 2 cell phones, and a small amount of marijuana. Cooley acknowledged that he has an agreement with the state for a 15-year sentence on aggravated robbery charges in exchange for his truthful testimony. A formal plea agreement had not been presented on the charges that could lead to more than 30 years in prison for Cooley. Cooley admitted he initially lied to police, saying he was home during the robbery. When confronted with evidence of his involvement, he said he confessed. "It was like I was caught red-handed. I told them everything," said Cooley. The chaotic and traumatic moments endured by the Bloomington couple after three men barged into their home at gunpoint last year were displayed in the courtroom Thursday. Cooley testified that Miller proposed the break-in after learning from another man that the victim kept $50,000 in their home. "I just decided to go with him," said Cooley, 21, of his trip to the residence with Miller and an unidentified third person. The trio parked a block away from the home for about an hour and waited for two others to leave the residence before walking to the front door. A home security video shows the situation, calm as the homeowner plays with a small dog, turned to chaos as a woman answers the door. The man meets Cooley and tries to stop the first suspect as he enters the living room. The man is struck in the head with a gun brought by Miller after both victims were ordered to lie down on the kitchen floor. Cooley told jurors about directions Miller allegedly gave him for the break-in. "I was told to go in and watch the wife, but I ended up watching both of them," Cooley said. "Miller grew impatient with the victims during a search of the home," said Cooley. "He kept asking, 'Where's the money at and where's the gun?'" said the witnesses. After at least 30 minutes in the home, the three suspects left with a handgun, 2 cell phones, a small amount of marijuana, a small purse containing about $100, and another $5,000 in cash, according to Cooley. The third suspect, who allegedly drove Miller and Cooley to the home, has not been arrested. Cooley claims he does not know the identity of the driver. Closing arguments are expected Friday in the 3-day jury trial. Continuing with a little bit of political news, our next article is entitled "Hales Reported a Finalist for Joliet City Manager" by Maria Nagel. The Joliet Herald News is reporting that Bloomington City Manager David Hales is a finalist for the same job there. Hales, who has been Bloomington's City Manager since 2008, could not be reached Thursday for comment. Joliet Mayor Bob Odekirk and other city officials there could not be reached. The Joliet newspaper quoted Joliet Councilman Terry Morris as saying Hales was one of the final candidates to replace former Joliet City Manager Jim Hawk, who retired in May. Morris did not respond Thursday to Pantograph telephone calls and emails requesting comment. The story also states that 79 candidates applied for the job, with the city beginning to interview 9 finalists on July 31st. A decision could be made at Joliet Council's October 3rd meeting, the Herald News reported. Hales has been a finalist for similar jobs in 2 other communities. In March, Hales withdrew his name from consideration as one of 3 out-of-state finalists to replace retiring Racine, Wisconsin City Administrator Tom Friedel. Hales was among 5 finalists selected in July to fill the vacant city manager's position in Topeka, Kansas, but he was not hired. In May 2016, the Bloomington City Council approved extending Hale's contract 18 months through July 11, 2018. The contract extension was shorter than 2 previous contracts for Hales, whose first contract began December 8, 2008. In April, the City Council approved a 1.9% salary increase for Hales, taking his annual pay retroactive to January 1st, from $185,190 to $188,660. His contract calls for an annual salary review subject to satisfactory performance evaluations. The Joliet paper reported the job there was advertised as paying $185,000 to $220,000. Next, we have an update in political news on the Illinois race for governor that's upcoming, with an article entitled Kennedy Announces New Running Mate Joy. Democratic candidate for governor Chris Kennedy's newly announced running mate says he wants to work with Kennedy to address the senseless violence that plagues Illinois and took the life of his adult son earlier this summer. Kennedy on Thursday introduced Chicago political activist Ra Joy as his lieutenant governor candidate in the 2018 campaign, saying they would combine to bring a change from the status quo and a new direction for our state. Kennedy, the son of the late U.S. Senator Robert Kennedy and nephew of former President John F. Kennedy, is among more than a half dozen Democrats running in the March primary for a chance to unseat Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Joy, 44, is executive director of Change Illinois, a nonprofit group that helped get automatic voter registration signed into law this year after Rauner vetoed it. Kennedy called that measure, which provides people interacting with a state office the opportunity to be registered to vote, the greatest single piece of good government legislation in a decade in Illinois. Joy's son, 23-year-old teacher Javier Joy, was shot and killed in June, apparently by someone trying to steal his cell phone. As a parent, that is the most excruciating experience you can ever have, he said in a campaign video released Thursday. Joy said he found kinship with Kennedy, whose father and uncle were both assassinated. He said he looks forward to working on a solution to gun violence, which has spiked in recent years in Chicago. Kennedy, earlier this year, released his plan to address the issue. It includes licensing gun dealers and creating a gun tracing program to trace ownership of firearms used in crimes, as well as increasing the number of Chicago police officers on the streets and providing better access to mental health care for kids who attend schools affected by violence. Joy is a native of Evanston, who graduated from Southern Illinois University, where he played football. He and his wife live on Chicago's South Side. The other Democrats seeking the nominations include billionaire businessman J.B. Pritzker, State Senator Daniel Bliss, and Chicago Alderman Amiya Pawar. Continuing on, our next article is entitled Reported Attendance Phony. School at Cook County Jail Falsified Student Data. The Inspector General for the Chicago Public Schools announced Tuesday that an alternative high school inside Cook County Jail has been falsifying student credits and attendance for years. Nicholas Schuler called the York Alternative High School a credit mill and is urging the firing of its principal, Charnette Sims. Schuler's 7-page report says York has routinely granted attendance and course credit to students who've left the jail or have been moved to solitary confinement where they couldn't attend classes. There is an example of a student who had gotten out of jail and was killed a week later, but was still being listed as attending classes. The report says from 2012 to 2016, about 342 students freed from jail were improperly kept on the attendance rolls. According to Schuler, the school also had a deficient and dishonest course structure that combined multiple courses in a single classroom. He said they were under the direction of teachers who were unaware of which students needed which classes. As a result, the program last year boasted some of the district's highest attendance and credit attainment metrics of the city's options schools for students who have dropped out of traditional high schools or are in confinement. In other educational news, we have a brief story on my own alma mater entitled Freshman Enrollment Up at NIU. Freshman enrollment at Northern Illinois University has increased for the first time in 6 years. However, total enrollment at the university located in DeKalb is down. The Daily Chronicle reports NIU welcomed 1,852 freshmen for the 2017-18 school year, a 3% increase from last year. Because of the departure of larger graduating classes, however, NIU's total enrollment decreased by 5%. Overall enrollment is down from 19,015 last fall to 18,042, including 13,454 graduates, 4,319 graduate students, and 269 law students. NIU Vice President Saul Jensen says in a statement, the university is encouraged to see increased efforts to market the university has led to a bigger freshman class. He said a more focused and personalized marketing effort will be key in offsetting the loss of upcoming graduating classes. Next, we have a brief report titled Illinois Poet Laureate Leaving. Illinois Poet Laureate Kevin Stein is stepping down from his post in December. Stein says in a statement issued by the governor's office that it's been an honor that's deepened his understanding of poetry and the state's diversity. Stein was appointed at the end of 2003 and has participated in about 250 poetry readings, presentations, and school visits. He's a professor of English at Bradley University in Peoria. Governor Bruce Rauner says he'll establish a search committee to start the laureate selection process. The new laureate is expected to be announced in the coming months. Stein is the state's fourth poet laureate. His predecessor included two Pulitzer Prize winners, Gwendolyn Brooks and Carl Sandburg. Next up, we'll move to international news with a story entitled South Korea, North Fires Missile, Object Flies Over Japan, Second Such Test Firing in Less Than a Month. South Korea's military said North Korea fired an unidentified missile today from its capital, Pyongyang, that flew over Japan before landing in the northern Pacific Ocean. It was the second aggressive test flight over the territory of the close U.S. ally in less than a month, and it followed the sixth and most powerful nuclear test by North Korea to date on September 3rd. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the missile traveled about 2,300 miles while reaching a maximum height of 478 miles. The missile was launched from Sunan, the site of Pyongyang's international airport. North Korea last month used the airport to fire a Hwasong-12 intermediate-range missile that flew over northern Japan. The North declared it a meaningful prelude to containing the U.S. Pacific Island territory of Guam and the start of more ballistic missile launches toward the Pacific Ocean. South Korean experts said the August launch was Pyongyang's attempt to make missiles flying over Japan an accepted norm as it seeks to test new projectiles and win more military space in the region dominated by its enemies. The offices of Guam Homeland Security and Civil Defense said the latest launch posed no immediate threat to Guam or the marinas. South Korea's Defense Ministry said the country's military conducted a live fire drill of a Hyunmoo-2 ballistic missile in response to today's North launch. Seoul's presidential office said President Moon Jae-in has scheduled a National Security Council meeting to discuss the latest launch. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged China to use its leverage as North Korea's principal supplier of oil to press the isolated nation into reconsidering its development of nuclear weapons. The Trump administration sought an embargo on oil imports to North Korea at the UN Security Council this week in response to the North's most powerful nuclear test to date. But opposition from China and Russia forced the UN to approve weaker measures, although it did ban textile exports, an important source of its revenue for the North. Tillerson said it was going to be very difficult to get China to consent to an embargo against its neighbor, but he still urged China, as a great country and a world power, to use its leverage as the supplier of virtually all North Korea's oil. That is a very powerful tool, and has been used in the past, Tillerson said at a news conference. We hope China will not reject that. Also, the top commander of U.S. nuclear forces said Thursday he assumes the September 3rd nuclear test by North Korea was a hydrogen bomb, suggesting a heightened U.S. concern that the North has advanced to a new level of nuclear firepower. Air Force General John E. Hyten, commander of Strategic Command, told reports that while he was not in a position to confirm it, he assumes from the size of the underground explosion and other factors that it was a hydrogen bomb. Continuing with international news, the next article is entitled Russia Fires Cruise Missiles into Syria. Activists say 20 civilians killed in fanatical bombardment. Russia fired a salvo of cruise missiles at the Mediterranean on Thursday and said they struck Islamic State targets in eastern Syria. Activists there said at least 20 civilians were killed in what they described as a fanatical bombardment, blaming some of it on Russia and some on the United States. It was not clear whether there was a connection between the Russian military strikes and the activists' accounts, reflecting the challenge of verifying the conflicting claims in the hostile environment of Syria's civil war, now in its seventh year. The seven caliber cruise missiles launched from the submarines Veliky Novgorod and Kolpino hit IS installations in Deir el-Zour province, the Russian Defense Ministry said. The province is where forces backed separately by Washington and Moscow are racing to seize territory in the jihadist group's shrinking Euphrates River Valley domain. But Turkey-based activist Omar Abdulayla said their local contacts reported fanatical levels of bombardment on three IS-held towns and villages along the valley, far more than could be accounted for by seven missiles, including an attack on the National Hospital in the IS stronghold of Al-Mayadeen, where six civilians were reported killed. Abu Layla puts the toll at 20 killed across the province. He added that the provincial capital, also called Deir el-Zour, suffered heavy airstrikes as well. Russian-backed pro-government forces have been on the offensive to take back the city after breaking an IS siege there last week. And moving back to domestic news, we have an article entitled "Trump Visits Florida, Examines Devastation. President Tells Local Residents, We're Here For You 100%. President Donald Trump doled out hoagies and handshakes in the sweltering Florida heat on Thursday as he took a first-hand tour of Irma's devastation and liberally dispensed congratulatory words about the federal and state recovery effort. Trump, who was in and out of the state in about 3 hours, got an aerial view of the water-deluged homes along Florida's southwestern coast from his helicopter, then drove in his motorcade along streets lined with felled trees, darkened traffic lights, and shuttered stores on his way to a mobile home community hit hard by the storm. Walking along a street in Naples Estates with his wife, Melania, the president encountered piles of broken siding and soggy furniture sitting on a porch front, and residents and volunteers who were happy to get a presidential visit. "We are there for you, 100%, Trump said before donning gloves and helping to hand out sandwiches to local residents from a lunch line under a canopy. "I'll be back here numerous times. This is a state that I know very well." As he left the state, Trump told reporters on Air Force One that he planned another hurricane-related trip to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, which were both badly hit by Irma. "I spoke to both governors. We've got it very well covered," Trump said. Trump earlier met with federal and state leaders in Fort Myers, where he was brimming with enthusiasm for the state and federal response effort, calling it a team like very few people have seen. Trump's visit offered him the chance to see how people are coping with Irma's aftermath and how Federal Emergency Management Agency is responding. "Many Florida residents remain swamped and without electricity. Nearly 2.7 million homes and businesses were still without power Thursday. Also Thursday, Florida seniors were ushered out of stifling assisted living centers, while caregivers fought a lack of air conditioning with popsicles and cool compresses after 8 people died at a nursing home in the post-hurricane heat. Dozens of the state's senior centers still lacked electricity in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, and several facilities were forced to evacuate. While detectives sought clues to the deaths, emergency workers went door to door to look for anyone else who was at risk. 57 residents were moved from a suburban Fort Lauderdale assisted living facility without power to 2 nearby homes where power had been restored. Owner Ralph Marinson said all 5 of his Florida facilities lost electricity after Irma. Workers scrambled to keep patients cool with emergency stocks of ice and popsicles. Statewide, 64 nursing homes were still waiting Thursday for full power, according to Florida Healthcare Association. Including the nursing home deaths, at least 26 people in Florida have died under Irma-related circumstances, and 6 more in South Carolina and Georgia, many of them well after the storm passed. The death toll across the Caribbean stood at 38. That'll wrap up the first segment of the Pantograph News for today. My name is Matt Woodbury, and thank you for listening.